Yeah, the thing with this show is you can watch what you want or don't watch. It's just basically whatever we've seen. Assume we've seen some things. If you hadn't seen any movies, James, then you would suck as a podcast guest. But
I've seen too many movies this past week.
Exactly.
James, we need to get you on Letterboxd because I just need to understand, yes. Like, do you sleep?
I don't sleep well, and I would like to sleep more and more soundly, but it's been intermittent at best these last few months.
I can imagine there's some days like he watched 17 movies in one day.
I have a situation where I'll be like editing with like a headphones, like one ear on, one ear off, watching movies and like trying to like do Twitter all at once. And I'm not liking this anymore. It's too much.
All right. This is going to be wild. So, cause we can talk. So, all right. Well, we're on the podcast. This is Criterion Now 13. I don't know when I'm going to start that, but cause there's
lucky
a lot.
Lucky number 13.
Lucky. Yeah. Unlucky number 13 or maybe lucky. I don't know. I think I'm lucky to have you guys. So let me say who you guys are. So I always do this alphabetically. We have Dave Eves, and Dave, this is your 35th appearance, is that right?
Yes. Well, how many movies are we going to be talking about today? Because that might push it up to 40.
Oh, wow, a lot. But, you know, if you go by that metric, then you might be last in our list, because we talk about a lot of movies every week.
This is so true. I did have Zatoichi to bump me up, though.
That helped.
It helped a little bit.
And James Hancock, you're a new voice to this podcast, but you're not a new voice to me. We've talked a number of times. We're actually going to talk in person in a few months when I come up in August.
Yeah, we met in the flesh almost 2 years ago at that fateful pickup on South Street screening.
Wow, that long ago. Yeah, so James Hancock of Wrong Reel, thrilled to have you. One of my favorite people, two of my favorite people. So,
we like you too.
Okay, let's move on. Let's not stroke each other. And of course, James, I couldn't have a podcast without mentioning that we tend to get perverse. And so, warning for people that have kids and they're driving through drive-thrus, we're probably going to drop a few bombs. And in fact, I have a really inappropriate game I want to play with you guys. So,
beautiful.
Anyway, but we haven't cussed yet. So, should we just get it out of our system?
Now you're putting me on the spot, and I'm going to go all Snow White on you.
Okay,
I can feel my sphincter clenching up. I'm getting all nervous about being put on the spot.
You know, that's cool. It's got to be organic. So, okay, we'll wait for it to happen naturally, just like love.
Exactly.
All right, well, we always start by talking about what we've been doing lately. So, Dave, I'll start with you. What's been going on?
Oh, geez. I podcasted with James recently and with Jess about 70s disaster movies. I think that's the most recent thing I've been doing. I think I have another podcast coming out very soon that I recorded a little bit ago with Martin Kessler. We'll see what happens when that comes out.
We'll see. Hopefully it won't suck.
Yeah. I've already listened to the episode. It was very good. I just don't know if I was supposed to say anything about it. Oh, well. But the disaster movie podcast was super fun.
You didn't say what
it's
it was.
Just to give you a heads up, it's been going very, very well. People have been loving that episode.
People keep talking to me about it. People even recommended a book about 70s American films that I had to buy. It's called The Stewardess is Flying the Plane, and has Karen Black right on the cover. How could I not buy that?
Yeah, I haven't listened to it yet, but I think those are fun movies. So I just haven't seen enough. I feel like I'm not qualified to listen to it. But
this Dave will give you a crash course.
Yeah, okay. Dave and Jess have this incredible, contagious enthusiasm, and as I said on the episode, yeah, they need a platform of some kind where they're sitting side by side. I suggested just a YouTube channel where they're just reviewing like
something.
Italian giallo and stuff like that, but yeah, they are a ton of fun to talk to about flicks.
Yeah, she was on here, actually. I don't know if you've heard it, but one of our early episodes, we had the wife's perspective, or the soon-to-be wife perspective. Please tell Jess I said hello, by the way.
I will let her know.
So, okay, well, James, what have you been doing? You've been podcasting like crazy. So, James Wrong Reel?
I'm one of the hosts on Wrong Reel. And yeah, we just recorded episode 254 yesterday. But I had a really fun one for 250 where the actor who played Furio on Sopranos, Federico Castelluccio, he came on to talk about this film he directed called Brooklyn Banker, which also starred David Preval, who played Richie Aprile in season 2 of The Sopranos. So I got to talk to these two guys about Brooklyn Banker, but also about their experiences on The Sopranos. And David Preval, I mean, he was in Mean Streets, and he was also in like Ralph Bakshi's Wizards. So talking to these guys was a huge geeky cinephile thrill for me. So yeah, I was particularly proud of that episode.
Very cool. You know, I just hearing that number, 256, was it?
We just did 254 yesterday, but I haven't posted it yet.
So, and I just Googled when we had ours. Ours was 56. So,
nice.
Oh my goodness.
Almost 200 episodes ago. It seems like yesterday. So, and I think I'll probably, well, actually, I know, I don't know if we can say or if this is, there's a code, but I know I'll be there probably before 270. And in fact, the three of us, are we allowed to say, talk about this, James?
Talk about, I don't know. Well, I can't answer that without knowing what we're going to talk about.
Well, we're, a couple people are going to do a podcast in a few weeks on Powell and Pressburger.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, very cool. Yeah, no, we can, yeah, there are no secrets at Wrong Reels. So, no, I'm very fired up for that.
So, I guess eventually, the three of us will be reuniting in a few weeks, and we'll talk about some awesome British directors, co-directors, sort of.
My question is for you guys, though. I will watch a movie projected in 8mm on a dirty sheet, but I know sometimes you guys like to watch things in pristine versions. Can we find a copy of Stairway to Heaven, aka A Matter of Life and Death, that is up to y'all's standards?
Oh, I've seen it.
I'm about that.
It doesn't exist, but what's out there is just fine. I can watch maybe not the 8mm version, but if it comes down to it, I'll watch. The shitty prints.
Yeah. I got very lucky where I got to see that in a pristine 35mm print at the Egyptian in LA for my very first screening. And that actually might have been my first Powell Pressburger experience.
Wow.
And I was floored.
Yeah.
And that's what got me on the hook.
I'm jealous.
We'll pick up that. I still have a couple I need to watch for that. I feel pretty qualified. So anyway, what I've been doing, I'm doing this every week, but we also finally kicked off our Duvivier series, and I don't know he's very obscure, so he might be too obscure for you, James. Have you seen Pepe Le Moko or anything?
I saw Pepe Le Moko at the New Art in LA.
Nice, nice. Big fan. And we recorded one episode on the Eclipse Viewer where we talked about the two of the films from the Eclipse set, and just this morning we recorded... just like an overview and some of his bigger films of the 30s, including Pepe Le Moko. And then we're going to follow it up with another, the last two films of The Eclipse. So that was fun.
Does Jean Gabin appear in a bunch of those, or was it just Pepe Le Moko?
He does.
He's one of your guys. I mean, just from your icon on Skype and on Twitter, you obviously
he's my
are
dude.
A fan.
Although that's like the one I had around like years ago, and I just haven't changed it. So, but yeah, no, I'm a fan. That's my what do they call it? It's my
avatar.
It's my jam.
It's your jam.
He's the French John Wayne. I am a fan.
All right. Well. All right. Since. Here we go. Are you guys ready for this game thing?
No.
Look,
can you ever be ready for these games that you spring upon us?
Yeah. No, I think you can. I mean, just being yourself is fine. So, okay. All right. Well, I mentioned that that James, sometimes you like to get in the toilet. Legendary, the first time I heard you guys was Salo, your commentary, and I don't know what episode that was. Probably in the teens?
I think it was like 28 or something like
okay.
that. Yeah, that was early, yeah.
Yeah, it was very early. In fact, I'm 27 too late. but yeah, you like to get a little perverse. And Dave, you're a frequent guest. You like to roll along with it. So so we're going to have a jerk-off.
Oh, God.
Not a real jerk-off, guys.
Oh.
I was about to say, because yeah, I already did one this morning. Like, the second one's always much harder. So.
You can't really do that on Skype. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to have a contest, but it's going to be about who's the bigger jerk. So it's, you know, we had a samurai off a few weeks ago, and so this is a jerk off. So whoever's the biggest jerk, you guys choose. So we're going to play the music. It'll be the same music that the game show music that you know, Dave.
Yes, I do.
You gave
I know
me.
It quite well.
You too. But it kind of sounds like porno music, which actually I think fits even better here.
Oh, no.
So somebody told me that.
Oh, no. Do they not watch Match Game?
who watches Match Game anymore, really? Besides you, Dave, and Jess.
Yes.
So, okay. All right. Who's the biggest jerk or the biggest villain? You know, whatever. This is just a list I came up with. So, okay.
Remind me of Quien es Más Macho on SNL. Quien es Más Macho, Fernando Lamazo, Ricardo Montalbán.
I don't know it. So, okay, speaking of which, so who's worse? Who's the biggest jerk? The Italian dudes from Salo or the Germans from Army of Shadows, Au revoir les enfants, Shoah, Night and Fog, and The Great Dictator? Just Germans in film or the Italian dudes from Salo? James, who's the jerk?
Salo.
Okay.
I have to go with the Nazis.
I think I'm with the Nazis too. Yeah, They're both dicks, but I think the Nazis are bigger dicks. So, James, sorry, you lose.
Okay.
That, but we have more. More where this came from. So, okay, who's the biggest dick? Death from the seventh seal or the devil from the last temptation of Christ? Dave.
The devil. Death's just doing its job.
All right, James, what do you think? Death or
I
devil?
I have to agree with Dave on this one.
Yeah, but the thing is, death, yeah, he does, he's going to kill him, though, so.
He gives him a chance.
At the last temptation, at least, you know, spoiler alert, he comes back, dude. Well, kind of. And he gets married. It's very controversial. That's good. All right, which is the biggest dick? The iceberg from, well, it's really Titanic, but I'm going with A Night to Remember here, or the asteroid from Armageddon? James.
Armageddon.
You like the asteroid, all right? Dave.
I'm going to go with the iceberg as the bigger dick. I'm changing it to asteroid because we got great movies from that iceberg.
It's the size of Texas.
Yeah, well, yeah, the iceberg, I guess, killed like a few thousand people.
I'm changing it back to the iceberg. It killed real people.
Well, the asteroid could, yeah, what they should have done is they should have flown somebody to the iceberg to stop it from killing the people, and then
I want that movie where Bruce Willis needs to go back in time to blow up the iceberg that destroyed the Titanic.
An Iceberg to Remember. All right, yes. We just pitched it, Hollywood. Okay, all right. Who's the biggest jerk? Hannibal Lecter from Silence of the Lambs or Harry Lime from The Third Man? James.
I mean, Harry Lime is my spirit shaman. He's my hero. I aspire to be an amoral son of a bitch like him, so I have to go Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, Dave, what do you think?
For the same reasons, I have to go with Harry Lime.
Yeah, Harry Lime, he just is okay with killing mankind. He just doesn't care. Hannibal Lecter, he's just got to eat. He's just hungry. So I'm going to go with Harry Lime. All right. And by the way, if you haven't seen, I think you guys have probably seen all these, but if you haven't, just pass or just make something up. So who's the biggest jerk? The Peeping Tom from Peeping Tom, his name is Mark Lewis, or Raymond from The Vanishing? Dave.
Raymond from The Vanishing. He's like a true psychopath.
James.
Completely agree.
Yeah, that's really dickish. I mean,
That's more terrifying than what happens in Peeping Tom. Oh, Peeping Tom's pretty terrifying, but just like that. I did
creepy.
Something good, so now I need to do something bad. That's like horrifying.
Yeah, it's creepy, and I'm not condoning what Peeping Tom or what he's doing, but yeah, the way Raymond's just truly sadistic, so mm-hmm. Fuck him. All right, who's the biggest jerk? The Blob or Godzilla? Dave.
The Blob.
The Blob? You got to back that up.
The Blob just, it doesn't care. Godzilla, nuclear weapons, like, he's just, like, fighting back. That Blob, he just doesn't care at all.
He'll just, okay. James.
The Blob's indifferent, but Godzilla's a victim. I mean, he was being, I have to agree. Yeah, the Blob is definitely jerk number one.
Yeah, you're right. The Blob is kind of a jerk. Yeah, no, I'm with it. Godzilla's just trying to live. He just is like...
Yeah, he's just trying to mind his own business when nuclear war just kind of changes everything.
Yeah, I think...
And this
think
is the, coming from me, who's... And the Blob is a local. He's from Phoenixville.
Yeah, that's true. He's a local. So you hang out with him and have a beer.
Exactly. I do at Blob
Really,
Fest.
Japanese are the jerks.
I've actually met the physical Blob.
Wow. All right. Well, okay. All right. We'll talk about that in a second. We have a few more. All right. Which is the biggest jerk? The house from House or the Brood from the Brood? James.
Now, is this House suit or is this House like Ding Dong You're Dead 80s house?
Oh, House suit.
All right. Oh, so you say who the Brood from the Brood or the House from House?
Yeah.
House suit? I'm going to go the House because the Brood, they didn't ask to be the product of this, like a byproduct of rage and frustration and this weird process. So, yeah, I got to go with the House on this one.
All right. Dave.
This is tough. I'm going to say that just because I like the House from House more, I'm going to go with the Brood. They're the bigger dicks.
Yeah, the House is just trying to live.
It's just trying.
Poor babies don't even have a navel.
It's kind of like the Hannibal Lecter syndrome. It's hungry, and that's how it lives. The Brood is okay. They're victims, but they also like they beat shit up.
But if you're talking about the mother, then that would be a different conversation.
Yeah,
the babies they just want to walk around in cute parkas in the snow and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we kind of are talking about the mother with the house, the grandmother, whatever. All right, so
with both, right.
A couple ladies here. Sister Ruth from Black Narcissus or Carol from Repulsion? Dave.
Oh, geez. I'm going to have to go with Sister Ruth.
Okay.
But she's a great villain.
James.
I got to side with Dave on this one. But yeah, she's fascinating.
I think you're right. Sister Ruth is the correct answer. Carol is, she's just fucked up, man. She just has problems. Well, not that Sister Ruth doesn't, but she's more vindictive. No.
All right. You said you were grateful.
All right, which is the biggest jerk? The fox from Antichrist, you know, the Chaos Reigns fox, or the Satanist from Rosemary's Baby? James.
Ooh, gotta go, yeah, Antichrist. I actually kind of like the Satanist from Rosemary's Baby, and if, you know, as a New Yorker, if I got invited to join their coven, I very well might do so.
It might be just down the street from you. So, Dave, Chaos Reigns or Rosemary?
I'm going with option C, Lars von Trier himself.
All right, and a lot of people, I'm not even going to go there, but a lot of people would go Polanski. But I'm going to go Ty, because they're both all for destruction. They're both really for Chaos Reigns, if you really think about it.
Yeah.
All right, here's a good one. Ripley from The American Friend or Ripley from Purple Noon? Dave?
Purple Noon, Ripley.
Okay, James?
Have to pass, have not seen American Friend, and it embarrasses me to no end to admit that.
Oh, it's a good movie. You should
it's
watch
good,
it.
Yeah, you should watch it. But I'm with you.
Yeah, it's got Nicolas Ray. I mean, and, yeah, I'm all in.
This was a trick question. The answer is Purple Noon. He's really not that much of a dick in American
Friend. No, he's a nice guy in that one.
I mean, he's okay. I mean, I guess he has problems. Yeah. All right, this is the last one. All right, old Benjamin Button or young Benjamin Button? Dave.
Brad Pitt.
James.
I would have to say I'm the bigger jerk because I didn't bother to see the movie.
You have not seen Benjamin Button, but that's cool, actually.
Yeah, I think in the Criterion circle, that makes you the winner.
I will never see that movie because I don't want to see a whole movie where the whole purpose of it is to see Brad Pitt eventually get to be young and hot. I'm like, I already know he's young and hot, so no, that's not a huge reveal.
I actually kind of wish I could unsee it. So, all right, that's the correct answer. All right, well, don't see it. That was the jerk off. So was that fun?
Who's the bigger jerk, though, between James and I?
I came like six times. So it was a successful game.
We're all jerks. We're just in a big circle. So, all right. Well, getting back to Criterion stuff. And by the way, James, you're not a big. I mean, you're a big film buff, and so you've seen a lot of Criterion films. But you're not like the Criterion geek that me and Dave are.
Not even close. Like, the way I put it is like, if I'm preparing for an episode and we're covering a filmography of, say, Ken Russell or whomever, and I'm going through all the best places to see someone's films, and I see something's available on Criterion, I'm like, yes!
Yeah.
I know it's going to look beautiful, and it's going to have all these great supplements, but I don't look at the announcements. I mean, I didn't even get a Filmstruck subscription until you and I were preparing for our Fassbender episode. So while I love and appreciate Criterion, I am not part of the inner circle at all.
Oh, I hope you did. Well, Filmstruck is cool, but I hope you didn't get it just for us and waste your money. Or I hope you got the trial.
Well, it's not a waste of money. Because yeah, and I've been using it since. But that was the catalyst that got me to get my subscription.
Oh, and I should add that you guys did an episode talking about Criterion, and I'm going to put that in the show notes for Ooh. People to listen to because that was a good episode. All right, so well, if you can just slum it with us, James, a little bit, and I'm sure you'll have plenty to say because you. Like,
for me, I view it as an opportunity to get an education because even though I've spent the last 2.5 years doing nothing but researching and talking about and promoting movie stuff, I get a little intimidated when we get into like the minutiae of the world of Criterion.
All right, we got you off your guard. That actually is impressive. But, James Hancock is like really, yeah, he's clenched up. He's ready to go. All right. Well, okay, this week we have coming out, and James, we just go by whatever happens during the week. So that's what the show and whoever's on, their opinions and what comes out, what happens. So this week coming out, we have the couple Demi films, Umbrellas of Cherbourg and Young Girls of Rochefort. And then, actually, I'm sorry, this was the previous week. And then coming up this week is Women of the Year and Buena Vista Social Club. So, Dave, any thoughts on any of the four? Excited? Not?
I have the two that are about to come out pre-ordered. I already had the two Demi films from the box set. I guess it makes sense if you're going to be splitting things off from box sets. Because those are great films. I love – those are the two standouts from the set.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to be a completionist, you don't want to see all of them, I don't blame you if you just want to buy those two. Lola, you might be missing out on, and Donkey Skin is also worth seeing.
Yeah.
But,
some people might be cool with not having to deal with donkey skin.
I think donkey skin is at least interesting to watch.
Actually, there's going to be a connection later with donkey skin, so I'm going to save that. But okay. James, any thoughts on any of the four? Have you seen them?
I mean, Buena Vista Social Club, I saw it in the theater when it came out, and I feel like it's one of the few movies in Wim Wenders' career where it kind of flies in the face of the idea that his movies aren't necessarily quote-unquote fun to watch. Like, I think a lot of people find his movies fascinating and interesting, but from the moment the first notes of music begin in Buena Vista Social Club, I remember I was thinking just, oh, this is just one of the most magical experiences I've ever had, and I just got sucked in, and I had the CD, and I played it on a loop in my car, and yeah, I need to revisit Buena Vista Social Club. It has been entirely too long.
It's a fun movie, yeah. And by the way, you don't buy physical media, right, James?
I mean, I will buy like a graphic novel if I can't get it online. If it's like a Alejandro Jodorowsky, like, you know, The Borgias drawn by Milo Manara, like that, you can't get online. So you got to buy the actual physical book, and it's a worthy investment. But yeah, as living in a small apartment in New York, I'm trying to reduce my earthly belongings, not increase them.
Yes, there's not much shelf space there. So, okay, well, I buy them all, so sorry. I just do. I actually pre-ordered these from Target. They had some sale.
Really?
So, and I actually forgot about it, and I got the shipping notice late in the week, and I was like, oh, crap, I hope I didn't order these from Amazon. And I checked, and I didn't. So I
quick question. With y'all's level of snobbery is the wrong word, but with y'all's level of, I guess,
you can use snobbery,
meticulousness over where, when and where and how you watch things, does that play into where you get the media from? Like, is there an element of snobbery about where you shop? Like, man, I can't buy this from Target. I have to buy this from so-and-so.
No.
Classier place.
Cheap.
Or whoever has the cheapest deal. That's where I go.
And, unless it's like a long wait. Like, some people will wait for the Barnes & Noble sales or the flash sales. Like, but I'm not going to do that. I just like to get them wherever I can get them, as close to the release date, as cheap as possible.
So if you buy Persona from Walmart, it's not tainted by buying it from Walmart.
Not at all.
It hasn't happened before, but no. Yeah, I mean, there's Costco, and I don't have a problem with Costco, but you know, it's a big box store. It's not it's the corporate. Well, they're all corporate. Yeah. So yeah, I don't care. Sometimes the Barnes & Noble has pretty bad shipping because they do this like shrink wrap thing with the package. So one of my box sets came out all messed up, and some people do care about that, but I really don't. I still watch the movies; they play fine.
I try not to order box sets online just because I'm afraid, because the digipacks, I love them, but they do get damaged pretty easily.
They do. So, okay, well, let's get into some bummer news. And actually, this ties into some shared history with James and I. But Michael Bauhaus died this week. He hadn't been working a whole lot, but if you know him, he's done expert cinematographer. He's worked with Scorsese. He's worked with Coppola. Of course, Fassbender, and that's where James and I talked about it. And I think some others. I didn't pull his filmography up. But he actually, I'll just list his criterions. He's got the Fassbenders, a lot of those, and also Broadcast News and The Last Temptation of Christ. So I'll start with you, James. What do you think about Michael Bauhaus?
It's the generic answer, but I immediately think of just the polish of Goodfellas. And, you know, it's one of those movies that I grew up watching. I discovered it in high school. Long before The Cinephile, I was a fan of Goodfellas, and I was enjoying Bauhaus, even though I didn't know I was enjoying Bauhaus. But I think it's Scorsese's best-looking movie, and Bauhaus deserves the lion's share of the credit for that, probably, because it doesn't look like any other Scorsese movie. If you look at, like, Robert Richardson's work on Casino, it is a total departure from Bauhaus's work on Goodfellas. So, yeah, I mean, I later on discovered the Fassbender work and stuff like that, but yeah, he's one of the essential DPs of my lifetime. So the world of film is poorer in his absence.
Yeah, but there's the big shot where they go under the club, and Scorsese diagrammed that shot and envisioned it, but I don't know that a lot of DPs could have pulled that off. Other than Bauhaus really was talented, and when we explored Fassbender, I remember when I learned that Fassbender would basically do like one or two takes, and he's getting this awesome camera work. I think a lot of that was Bauhaus. He basically didn't care a lot. So yeah, it's sad that he's gone. He was getting up there though.
What's crazy is people who don't care about movies or don't care about photography or any of that stuff, even they will talk about how great his work is in film. So that's when you know you're breaking through, when like casual kind of everyday movie watchers who just watch it just for comfort food are like, oh my God, this is really good photography.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And if you just look at his filmography, in fact, I had forgotten some of the movies he did, and I think visuals. There are some clunkers, but you know that's going to be the case with anybody working in Hollywood.
I just looked through his filmography because I was aware that he died, but unfortunately, with me, when I'm watching a movie, I'm typically looking like, oh, that's the director. The cinematographer mm-hmm. isn't typically like the name that always sticks out. And it's a shame because this guy's done a lot of amazing work. Yeah. I'm like floored just looking through the filmography right now.
Yeah, he's done
Color of Money, baby.
Well, also Quiz Show. You know, that was just like a quiz show, kind of like the jerk off we just did, but it looked good.
Shot Papa Don't Preach. Yeah.
He did The Legend of Bagger Vance and Wild Wild West. So that's a little bit of infamy.
But you know what? Those movies looked great. The way he photographed that giant mechanical spider.
Yeah.
he filmed it all at the magic hour. To
he really shined that shit up real good. So, well, he was 81 when he passed. I don't know how he passed. It's actually been a busy week because I've been prepping for two shows, kind of like James here. James probably been prepping for five shows. But yeah, it's gone too soon, no matter how old he was. So
yeah, true icon of his craft.
He was. And his work will live on. There's still plenty. Actually, I've seen quite a bit of his work, but I'm sure there's plenty I haven't yet. Well, okay, let's move on to a big deal. Cannes announced their 2017 lineup. So quite a lineup here. And, you know, usually we don't talk about things that aren't related to Criterion. And I think this eventually will be related to Criterion. Of course, we don't know anything about the films yet. Some of them are going to suck. It just seems like that. There are always going to be one or two that disappoints. But if we just look at the directors, and here I'm going to review some. Dave, did you have any thoughts about Cannes this year?
This is where I'm unprepared. I don't know the lineup.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a Hanukkah. The Hanukkah is called Happy End, which is kind of, if you know Hanukkah, that's...
I don't believe him.
Yeah, lies. Not happening. there's a Yorgos Lanthimos, probably not going to be Criterion, but a good filmmaker. One I'm kind of interested in is it's called Le Redoutable. I don't know how you say that in French. It's by the guy that did The Artist, but it's about Jean-Luc Godard. So it's a biopic.
Very cool.
And it has the brunette guy from The Dreamers. Remember that movie? He plays Godard. I've seen some images, and I guess he kind of looks like Godard, but it could be terrible. Could be okay. There's also a Bombach. Do you like Bombach, James?
Kicking and Screaming was one of those college movies that we watched a lot just because we could really relate to it, and I really enjoyed Squid and the Whale. And also the fact that he made that great documentary about De Palma, which Dave and I covered on Wrong Reel. I love him as a figure, and I think he's very eloquent and well-spoken. He doesn't necessarily make the kind of movies that I'm like, you know, that I'm like my first thing I'm going to pull off the rack.
Sure. Because
it's a lot of character-driven, kind of talky, navel-gazing and that sort of thing. But I totally get why some people really, really admire his work. So I see his movies. I just don't obsess over them.
Yeah, they're really New York, too. So you probably recognize a lot of the locations.
He's a very slick motherfucker, too. And yeah, I watched him at the Film Society of Lincoln Center two years ago, actually, interview De Palma. And I wish I had like an ounce of his polish and fashion sensibility and great hair and all that. Yeah, he's the full package in terms of being a New York guy.
I want to be Noah Baumbach. Yeah. Well, actually, no, I want to be Todd Haynes. He's got a movie called Wonderstruck coming out. Collection has Safe, so it's possible. Oh, and there's also a Lynn Ramsey, Ratcatcher. So let me just get through the other ones. There's a Kiyoshi Kurosawa. He doesn't have a Criterion, but... Kira's been rumored.
Out of competition, we got a new Takashi Miike, Blade of the Immortal.
We do, which will probably be a lot of fun. And generally, the movies are good. So I think, and they've seen them. There's also John Cameron Mitchell and Agnes Varda at a competition, too. So,
oh.
And Varda was just at Criterion, so
She took a nap.
She took a nap, yes. See, you don't know that. You miss all this stuff, James.
Well, I do enjoy watching the videos at Criterion when someone comes in and just starts pulling things off the rack. That's the little taste of Criterion that I do indulge in, and so I periodically dip my toes in those waters.
Yeah, she didn't do a closet video. I'd love to see one, but I think she might have just been too tired. You know, she took a nap. I think the one I'm most excited about is 24 Frames, Abbas Kiarostami. I guess, kind of bittersweet because it's his last film. I think it's his last film. He doesn't have another one in the can, does he?
Oh, I didn't even realize he had one in the can.
Yeah, yeah. It's 2016. Wow. I don't know if it's played somewhere yet. So maybe that's why it's out of competition. Actually, I have no idea if it's any good. But you know, just out of respect for the man, even if it's not, I'm there.
I'm happy that they're playing two episodes of Twin Peaks. I'm looking forward to now.
Yeah. And Top of the Lake too, Jane Campion. So it's weird. TV, it can. I mean, I get it. It's modern. It's the new media, but it just feels weird.
Iñárritu has an installation, Carne y Arena, whatever that might be. But I just
sounds
like seeing
delicious.
That he's still acting. Yeah. You can eat the exhibit. It's great.
It's actually the bison liver that Leonardo DiCaprio ate.
Actually, probably, well, arena, so it's like meat arena, meat house.
Ooh. That sounds fun.
Yeah, I don't know if you can experience that from here. It's a VR thing. I don't know what the deal with that. I'm sure we'll find out. Oh, and also opening night is Arnaud Desplechin, Ismail's Ghosts. So he's, I like Desplechin a lot. He's been in the collection for A Christmas Tale, but Kings and Queen is a movie I like a lot. Dave, have you seen anything from Desplechin?
I've only seen A Christmas Tale. That was okay.
Yeah, I'd say that's middling. Yeah. James, you like him?
If I know his work, I can't place into his name with any of his films.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, that might be a podcast. I think he's relevant. He's modern, too. So My Golden Days a couple years ago, that was supposed to be good, and I meant to watch it, but I forgot. So I guess I'll have to. Anything else about Cannes that jumps out at you guys? Or not including you, Dave, because you didn't prep.
I'm prepping as we record.
Okay, there you go, Dave. What do you think?
I just whenever I think of Cannes, I just think of red carpets and tuxedos and beautiful celebrities and that sort of thing. And so, just it's one of my life missions to not only go, but to go due to my involvement with a particular film. Like the director I work with, Bill Plimpton, he went a couple of years ago because he's part of an anthology film that Salma Hayek produced called The Prophet. He did one of the – it was like 12 different animated shorts.
Oh, very cool.
And the pictures that I saw of them working the carpet, also him posing with Salma Hayek, I got very jealous. And I was like, you know what? My life is not – I would rather go to Cannes with a film in competition than go to the Oscars. I'll put it that way.
Okay, that's fair. Well, I know that there'll probably be 10 movies on this list that I adore. So that's just the way Cannes is every year. There's going to be something for me. So, you know, Criterion or not, there's probably going to be 10 on my shelf. That speaks about me. I can't help it. So, and of course, they have the classics lineup that'll be announced. It can be a week or 2 weeks after the main lineup. I think last year, if I remember right, it was really quick. It was like a few days. So we might be able to talk about that, next week, not with you guys. Sorry, but you can talk. You can talk to each other about it if you want.
And I was going to prep for that one too.
And usually there's some good restoration screenings. So, and I don't know if you geek out about that, James, the restorations that are coming out or no.
Well, definitely. I mean, New York, we're just really lucky. We have a ton of theaters, and more theaters keep opening that do a lot of restorations and retrospectives and that sort of thing. So a lot of times these movies, before they come out on Criterion, you know, Rialto or someone like that will put them out, like, you know, Chimes of Midnight had a theatrical run before it came out on Criterion on Blu-ray. So, yeah, in New York, we're very lucky on that front.
Have you been to the Metrograph yet?
I fucking love the Metrograph because it was cool. What they finally realized is that cinephiles are so – not antisocial, but they just spend a lot of time alone in the dark. They need a restaurant, a bar where they can hang out after screening. So the Metrograph built this incredible, very dark cafe where after you get out of seeing Double Indemnity or whatever you're there for, you can hang out and have a glass of scotch and talk to your fellow film enthusiasts. And the bartenders are really, really outgoing and will give you free shots to like keep you around.
Oh, my God.
And so they're really cultivating this incredible environment. And also the Lower East Side where it's located had almost no theaters of any kind, mainstream or indie or anything. So it just saw a huge market opportunity. But the Quad just reopened a couple of days ago, and they're doing a Lena Wertmuller retrospective.
I saw that, yeah.
So, yeah, that's big news. But, yeah, New York is kind of – it's. I mean, we're almost – I don't even know if we've reached a saturation point yet, but we're as close to one as we can get. And we have a new Alamo Draft House in Brooklyn. So we've had a bunch of new theaters
awesome.
Open in the last year, and they all seem to be thriving. So.
Yeah, well, when I come up in August, I want to go to the Metrograph. We got to go hang out at the Metrograph. Hopefully something good will be playing.
Oh, I mean, they're playing Ghosts in the Shell this weekend. They're playing all kinds. And not the ScarJo one, the original.
Yeah, you lost me for a second, but okay.
I was
going
to
say,
you'll need a drink after the new one.
They're playing the
You got to get bombed for it.
Yeah.
All right, Metrograph. I can't wait. All right, well, so we're recording this on the 15th, which is usually the week, the day of the month that Criterion announces, but today's Saturday. So and this episode will probably go up Monday. Actually, the announcements might be up for, are we at June or we're at July?
This is July.
Yeah, wow. And I know you don't orient your life around the 15th of every month, James, but I think it's safe to say that Dave and I do.
Yes. it's one of the most, it's one of the dates I look forward to most each month, yeah. The other being the day that they release the newsletter clue.
In fact, if I get busy at work and like I find out too late that 4 o'clock they came out and I like look at my phone at 6, I'm pissed off that I missed them.
I want to be the first eyes to see what new things they're releasing.
Me too. Me too. So, well, and you probably, I know you don't keep an eye out on the clues and all that stuff, the trying to figure out the speculation, James, but...
Oh, so they tease little details to kind of fuel the flames of speculation and everything? Oh.
Very much so, yeah. So, but do you... So, usually I'd ask a prediction, but I'll just ask, is there any wish list? Is there any film out there that you think really deserves the Criterion treatment that, you know, whether it's realistic or not?
Bring me the head of Alfredo Garcia by Sam Peckinpah.
Okay.
His most nihilistic, black-hearted film starring the great Warren Oates.
And this is how we know that James is not a physical media nerd, is because it's already out on Twilight Time Blu-ray. So and they have a... so
interesting.
It won't happen.
I didn't know that. What's Twilight Time?
Twilight Time is a label that... it is a good label, but they do a lot of American movies. Not all American movies, but it's mostly studio... classics, and but they do a limited run of like 3,000 for most of them, and maybe 5,000 for the better ones. And so, and then when they sell out, they sell out. Although Alfredo Garcia did sell out the first time, and they did a new version, which hasn't sold out yet. So you can buy that if you, but it's like $35. So that's the rub on them. Dave, do you have any predictions or wish lists?
Well, I want Stalker. I think everyone wants Stalker. I'm of the mindset that they save big releases for July and November because of the Barnes & Noble sale. They probably don't do that consciously. But my actual prediction, simply because I just bought a bare bones Blu-ray of it, Barry Lyndon. I think they're going to release that because I bit the bullet and bought it.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that.
If they do release it, you're welcome.
They're going to. You made it happen.
I did.
You sprinkled your magic dollar dust on that crappy DVD, and we get it. Well, they did. They're coming out with the Marseille trilogy in June, so that could be the big box set. But I think they might have another one. But I think I've wished for this a lot of times. But I'm just going to say Shame again by Bergman.
You get to see Liv Ullmann's boobies. Yeah,
there's that. And Dave, I know you're going to say Hour of the Wolf again.
I know. If they really want July to be a wonderful month, especially because my birthday's in July. Criterion, if you're listening, if you want to make my birthday month special, put out Shame and Hour of the Wolf on
and of
Criterion
course,
Blu-ray.
They're going to hear this probably after
Hour of the Wolf
it comes
has
out.
So many hardcore fans that even people who don't follow Bergman love Hour of the Wolf just because it's so disturbing. It's amazing that hasn't received the treatment to date. It seems like such an obvious contender.
Well, MGM had it, and they put out an okay edition, but I think actually that's one thing about physical media and Criterion, whether you're a snob about them or not, they do kind of put things back in the stratosphere, in the cult, or the public consciousness. So... Yeah, the MGM box set probably didn't do it.
No.
That's that. Let's do some short takes. And short takes, this is just a movie we've seen recently, Criterion we've seen. And James, it could be 5 months ago. I'm sure it hasn't been. But I'll start with you, Dave. What's your short take?
My short take is for a movie I literally finished 5 minutes before we started this podcast.
Nice.
I watched from the Martin Scorsese's World Cinema Project box set number one, since there will be a second one soon. I watched the Turkish film Dry Summer.
I haven't seen.
Ooh, it is good. It's my favorite one that I've seen off the box set so far. It has one of the most diabolical villains ever.
That's what I've heard.
And yeah. It's great because to him, he's the hero of his story. It's like the true best type of villain in the sense that he just, again, it's not like he's twirling his mustache, even though he's very mustachioed. He he wants what he wants, and everyone else is wrong. and it's wonderful and great, and I loved every second of it. But I will, I do unfortunately have to deem that box set the animal death box set. So if you're an animal lover, do tread lightly.
Okay, I won't have my wife there. But yeah. So okay, he's a good villain, but would he win a jerk off?
Yes, he would be the biggest jerk off
against Germans.
Maybe not against the Nazis.
Okay, maybe against Rosemary's Baby.
Yes.
Okay, fair. So, all right, that's a high vote. I might have to watch that.
It's amazing. Yeah, and great.
We're going to do a WCP one episode soon-ish. I can't remember if that's on the list. But anyway, James, you got a short take?
Yeah, well, I bent your rules because it's coming out. I don't even know how I know this, but coming out on June 27th on Criterion is Straw Dogs on Blu-ray. And I think this might be the first Peckinpah Blu-ray by Criterion, I believe. And the reason I brought it up is because in the episode that I listened to about Criterion Now before in preparation, somebody was making fun of Straw Dogs or saying they don't like it. I fucking love Straw Dogs. And I feel like in an era where we're trying to kind of put child bumpers or safety locks on everything around us at all times, especially like in social media, Straw Dogs is a great kind of FU, and it's probably one of the most shocking, controversial, horrifying, claustrophobic, nightmarish experiences you can ever subject yourself to. And that might not sound like a good thing, but I think it is. I like filmmakers who force us to face the dark side of man, movies that shock us out of our sense of complacency, and I just can't be more excited to see Criterion getting into the Peckinpah biz. So yeah, I'm all in on Straw Dogs coming out in, I guess, like 2 months' time. But yeah, I didn't see it, obviously, on Criterion recently, but I was preparing for a Peckinpah episode with Hellbent for Horror, and yeah, I think it's a kind of required viewing for people who like the dark side of cinema.
Well, guess what? It was already on Criterion, so you didn't really bend the rules. It's an upgrade.
Oh, very cool. was already on Blu-ray, or was it
it was on
DVD. So gotcha. They're getting a Blu-ray upgrade.
So I didn't bend the rules. Beautiful.
I can't remember who hated on Straw Dogs on our show.
Whoever was on Criterion Now with y'all when y'all were doing the Samurai Cinema.
Oh, well, that was Matt and Dave.
It wasn't me. I haven't actually seen the movie yet.
It was not Dave, so it must have been Matt.
Okay. Huh.
That jerk.
All right.
He's the real jerk off here.
Yeah. No, he couldn't have been a nicer guy. But I just, when I heard him say something bad about Straw Dogs, I was like, what?
He's a real nice guy.
On my Mount Rushmore of directors, Peckinpah is one of them. So.
All right, Matt, you're on notice. Matt, you lost the jerk off. So, okay. Well, my short take, that's a great one. I know you love your Peckinpah, so that was two Peckinpahs. So I would love Pat Garrity and Billy the Kid. That's not on DVD. I think there's problems with that, though.
Never be a definitive director's cut because Peckinpah died and was fired from the film when he only had his what's called the preview version available. And the preview version is exactly that. It's not a director's cut. It's been mislabeled as that. But after his death, that was basically marketed and shopped around as the closest version to his vision. Then the early 2000s, Paul Sador, Peckinpah historian and a very successful film editor, did a new cut, which I don't particularly like, which is usually the version you find if you're going to stream it. But the DVD always has the theatrical cut, the preview version, and the Paul Sador cut. I always steer people toward the preview version because it's the closest we're going to get. But we'll never have the definitive Peckinpah director's cut of that film. But it is one of my all-time favorite movies.
Well, one thing that Criterion does is they do multiple editions, multiple versions. Like the New World had three cuts. So maybe they just put them all in there and let us figure out.
Yeah, that's how they shoot. Like Mr. Arcadna did that. And like Brazil, they did that. So I like it when they let the viewer decide.
Yeah. Now, sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes they're... director's cuts are the best ones. Sometimes they're not, actually. Well, it wasn't Criterion, but Cinema Paradiso, I've harped on that director's cut as being terrible.
At least they included both versions.
What's that?
At least, for the Arrow Academy. I mean, they did include both versions.
So. They did. Yes. I made the mistake of putting the director's cut on for my wife, and she's like, why is this movie so... why do people love this movie? I'm like, I promise it's good.
I'm really glad I didn't watch the director's cut.
Yeah. And she can never unsee that go in fresh. So Cinema Paradiso is ruined for her.
I don't know.
All right, my short take is Stagecoach. And this is a big one. This is my first time watching it outside of a classroom, and... It's very technically proficient. John Ford obviously knew what he's doing. I I think Orson Welles was very inspired by him for.
Yeah, he watched it 40 times while preparing to shoot Citizen Kane.
And if you and you can get caught up in the technical magnificence. This time I tried, and like I said, it was a busy week. I was prepping, so I tried to just watch it as a Western entertainment and see how it held up that way. Not put my film analytical geek mind on hold and just watch it for fun. Not even think about John Wayne and all that, but and it holds up as entertainment. I think that's part of its charm. It's brilliant. It's something you can scrutinize and extract all sorts of themes. It's important. It, you know, kind of revitalized the Western. Of course, John Wayne does owe his career to that movie, but it also is quite a ride. And I tell you, the last third, you know, the first two thirds are pretty character driven and interesting, but the last third is really like an action film and great stunts. So I forgot
Yakima Canutt is one of the all time great stuntmen. He was the coordinator on that, and he does all John Wayne's stunts in it. And there's some of the most jaw dropping stunts I've ever seen.
Yeah, and
does he perform the big stunt in the movie?
Well, there's two big ones. There's one where he's jumping up to the front of the carriage in order to, because the reins have come loose from one of them, and the other one is when he drops down between and goes between all the horses and underneath it goes over him, and he also does a lot of the falls. And Yakima Canutt, he also went on like his son did all the stunts and Ben Hur. I mean, it's like a stunt family. but Stagecoach, man, he was like, he and John Wayne and John Ford were all just in their prime. And Dudley Nichols, the screenwriter, there's just so much to love about that flick.
Yeah, also Monument Valley too. That's I think that's the first time it showed up in a John Ford film. So
he never left.
He never did leave.
I remember watching that in college with a buddy of mine, and it ended, and he looked at me, he was like, do you want to watch that again right now? Like,
that's awesome.
Let's do it.
And, you know, I was thinking it was, you know, it's very highly acclaimed. And I think of it as, you know, the film school film, you know, one of the ones the critics love. And I looked at the Sight and Sound list. I don't even think it's on the Sight and Sound list, but it's on the AFI list. And I think that's wrong. I think it belongs in the upper echelon of the great films of all time. The Searchers pretty much takes that. You know, it's in top 10.
I mean, for John Ford admirers, and I count myself as one of them, I'm not part of like the Church of Scientology of John Ford. There's some people who like are deep in there, like, you know, who is it? Joseph
McBride.
Joseph McBride. Yeah, he wrote that great Searching for John Ford book. Like, there are guys who are really deep into that world. But if you like John Ford's films, Searchers is one of his absolute essentials. It's an extraordinary flick.
And I forget who wrote it, but I read a book. I listened to a book as a podcast a couple years ago about the Searchers. And there's a ton of depth there. That's one thing. You can watch a commentary. You won't get anything compared to a book. But I guess the thing is, I don't see the Searchers as being as entertaining. I think that's one I think is more you analyze, but that's just me. So but maybe I'll have to watch that again someday just to see if it thrills me.
Yeah, you start with Stagecoach and then work your way through like Fort Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, The Searchers. I mean, there's, and then finally, oh my God, I'm totally blanking on the, what was the one that Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne did?
Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Yeah. Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. But yeah, but that, just those alone, I mean, that's kind of like, it says everything you need to know about John Ford's approach to the Western. And he obviously made a lot of great films outside the Western genre, like The Grapes of Wrath. You know, The Long Voyage Home and How Green Was My Valley and all these extraordinary films. But the Western is definitely where I feel like you see his soul.
I like some of his lesser films too. Like, was it Three Godfathers?
I love that one, yeah.
Yeah, he was, as far as like studio directors that were prolific, I don't know how many films he cranked out a year on average. Probably at least one, I think.
He was doing, I'm very not as consistent. Well versed in John Ford as you guys, but Aaron, you actually recommended for me back when Filmstruck like first came out, the Whole Town's Talking. That was great.
Oh yeah, that's
Edward G.
Early
Robinson.
One.
I saw that. Did I recommend that? VHS in the late 90s.
Yeah. It's a fun one. It's very different from his later work. I mean, he pretty much got hung up doing westerns and a few other things, and of course, Grapes of Wrath. Speaking of Orson Welles, that's a Greg Toland vehicle. So yeah, John Ford rocks. So okay, let's get to Filmstruck. So Filmstruck. All right. So Filmstruck, as I just learned, you've just got it this week, James. So I hope you enjoyed it. But
No, I got it for our Fassbender episode, but back when we did it.
Okay.
Because there are like 50 of those Fassbender flicks that were available on it.
Yeah. Well, it's great. So okay. Well, we just basically use what they produce as content just as something to talk about. So and if you want, there's the April schedule. We're halfway through April. The whole list is on Criterion Cast or everything that's coming up. But we're just talking about what was out over the last week. So on the main channel, there was actually, these just came out this morning. There was a grouping of Kevin Kline movies, which I think is kind of interesting, and kind of not too. I like Kevin Kline fine, but do you guys have any strong opinions or positive or negative about Kevin Kline?
I think Kevin Kline is fantastic. I don't care how good or great or bad the movies are that he's in. He just seems like a nice guy.
I think that's fair. There is The Big Chill, so I will hold that against him. I'm sorry. James, I'll ask you, but let me see what movies they added. James, you like Kevin Kline?
I mean, I'm a child of the 80s, and I feel like he is a creature of that decade, so I've got a lot of sentimental fondness for him. But I don't, like, program Kevin Kline retrospectives in my home or anything like that. But,
you don't?
Yeah. Do you want to do a Kevin Kline episode?
No.
I say that for a big number. Wrong Reel 300, Kevin
Kline's been popular. But I do enjoy his performances, and yeah, he seems, as Dave said, yeah, he seems like a delightful human being.
Maybe you can get Kevin Kline. I think if you get Kevin Kline, you're going to talk about his damn movies.
I would definitely do my homework for that one.
The list is there's just three films: A Fish Called Wanda, which I do adore; Sophie's Choice, which is interesting. I think it's more for the term Sophie's Choice. We use that just in whenever. And then Queen to Play is one from 2009. I haven't seen that. Sandrina Bonaire from Vagabond and other things. And Kevin Kline. So it's Caroline.
Has he ever topped A Fish Called Wanda? I mean, I feel like Fish Called Wanda was just, he was so on fire in that role.
Yeah, I'd have to look at his filmography, but I think that if you talk about Kevin Kline comedy performances and in comedy vehicles, I think that's it. Yeah.
And obviously Wild Wild West.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah. But great cinematography too, and yes, I'm not making light of Michael Bauhaus. He's done some duds too. I'm looking at it now. De Lovely, No Strings Attached, Life Is a House. I think Dave was kind of funny, but
He was good in that.
Not this Dave that I'm talking to, the movie Dave. You're okay, Dave.
Thank you. I can never live up to the movie, obviously.
The movie version of yourself, where you're
exactly.
President,
and not president.
Yes, that one too.
He played Bottom in A Midsummer Night's Dream, which I never saw. But I remember seeing all the trailers where he's dressed up as Bottom.
I never saw that either. So, and I didn't see the trailers either.
I saw the trailers and I was like, oh, that's great casting. I'll never see this though.
Well, there's another grouping called Women of Substance that just came out today, and it says misogyny is practiced around the globe. So is resistance. So it's about six international films where they resist misogyny. So we've probably lost all the listeners that. So there's a movie called Bliss, Daughter of Khaltoum, Nina's Diary, Kadosh, Cairo 678, and Border Cafe. Border Cafe is the only one of these I'd heard of before today, and I don't think I've seen it. We have any comments here? Anybody seen anything?
I've seen none of these, but I'm going to check out this category.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine if they spent a day inside my head, they'd probably spend the rest of their lives like resisting me on all fronts. So, I have a feeling I probably should do some homework and watch some of those movies and enrich my palate.
Well, you know, if I want to think about international women resistance, I'm going to go Story of Women, Claude Chabrol. That was, what's her name? Huppert, one of the greatest actresses ever. Yeah, that was a mid-career role for her, late 80s, really good.
Chabrol's one of those guys where I just really need to do more homework. I saw Les Biches, which I loved.
Haven't seen
it. And it's just an extraordinary, like an erotic thriller, and it's so stylish, and I had such a good experience watching it, and then I was like, my response was to not watch any more of his movies, which is idiotic on my part.
I mean, he's worked for ages, decades, and it's all been pretty good, but different. La Ceremony, 95, or La Ceremony, That one's very good. I'd recommend that one. In fact, I'd highly recommend that one. And of course, it's early French New Wave films. So can you guys think of any female empowerment resistance movies of any type off the top of your head? And if you can, it's okay. So, but I'll just ask. Anybody got anything?
Like Catherine Bigelow is kind of a walking female empowerment director, and she has a new trailer just come out for Detroit, which is going to be released in August. And I like girls who empower females by leading by example. And she's like, look, I make kick-ass movies, and I don't let anyone tell me no, and I do my thing. I make movies on my own terms, and she's been doing so for like 30 years. And I feel like that's the kind of female empowerment for me that I find really inspiring, because on one hand, she'll make a movie like Near Dark, a great, gritty genre film, but then she'll make The Hurt Locker or Zero Dark 30, more politically themed movies. And I like the idea you can't like categorize her as, oh, she's the female empowerment director. No, she's just a living icon for that movement by virtue of the fact that she gets shit done and wins awards and makes movies that people love.
She does, yeah. Dave, can you think of any female empowerment movies?
The new Ghostbusters. No, I feel horrible that I'm kind of blanking on female empowerment movies. Obviously, there is a lot of controversy regarding that one. I think that it is a feminist take on movies in general. But no, I feel terrible. I feel like a misogynist.
You're not, dude. You're not. But I don't. I'd have to think. I'm sure there's plenty I'm missing. But I do like strong female characters, and I like when and I think that there are too few of them. Like if you look at even I know the Oscars don't really matter for shit, but if you look at the actor versus the actress category, usually the actress category is thinner. It doesn't have.
How dare you?
Sorry, except for Hooper.
Elle was my favorite movie of last year, and it just depressed me to no end that she did not take home a statue.
Yeah, she deserved that. Mainstream Hollywood clearly has the bias.
Who won? Oh, yeah, Offenses. Viola Davis. She was fine.
But, no. That best was actress still best, is Emma Watson.
Emma Stone.
Not Emma Watson.
Okay. Yeah.
Are you Faye Dunawaying it right now?
Yeah, exactly. I'm adding to the controversy. But yeah, L.A. loves movies about itself. La La Land.
It's fine. It's good. It's entertaining. But and Viola Davis was good too. And I think that's a lead performance. That's where it was categorized as supporting, which makes no sense. But so that's why I made that mistake. So okay, let's get back to Filmstruck. So okay, we have the Criterion Channel. So this week there's always a short plus feature that comes out on Tuesdays, and this week we had God Respects Us When We Work But Loves Us When We Dance, and that's Les Blank. It's a hippie fun thing in the park, and then there's Gimme Shelter. So you didn't have to prep, but have you guys seen the Les Blank movie, or have you seen any Les Blank? I'll start with you, James.
I've seen Gimme Shelter. Gimme Shelter is the shit. I love it.
It is a great movie. It's not Les Blank, but have you seen any Les Blank?
Did he make Burden of Dreams?
He did. Yes, he did. Yeah.
I love Burden of Dreams. And he did Werner Herzog Eats a Shoe as well, correct?
He did. Yeah.
I love that one, yes. I know his documentaries about Herzog.
Yeah, he actually does have really, really good work. I would recommend – he has weird subjects too. This one is really just a bunch of hippies dancing around. It's cool if you want to see the time capsule, to see what it was like back then. I mean it's – or kind of like when you watch Gimme Shelter and you see the people stoned. That's kind of fun. This is just all – that's all it is. So, Dave, thoughts?
I actually haven't seen a single Les Blank film. I don't know what I'm waiting for. They seem like movies that I'm really just going to enjoy. So maybe I should start with this one.
Burden of Dreams might be the best movie you'll ever see about the movie experience you don't want to have.
It's funny because I haven't seen Fitzcarraldo yet, and I'm waiting. Oh, I want to see Fitzcarraldo first, then watch Burden of Dreams. But Fitzcarraldo is like 2.5 hours. It's like, when am I going to have time for that?
It moves fast, though. It really does. You don't have to see it before, but I would recommend it because it's going to spoil Fitzcarraldo. And then after that, watch My Best Fiend, which is that's actually Herzog's himself documentary, but that pairs well. It's about him and Kinski. So we've already talked about Gimme Shelter, I think, two or three times on this show. So
it's coming up, so I should probably watch that.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Yes. Oh, it's one of my favorite documentaries about rock and roll ever. It's fascinating.
Yeah, but it's rough though. It's the Summer of Love, or maybe like the summer after the Summer of Love.
Yeah, Summer of Love. I think was like 67. This is like the hangover of the flower power movement when things started to get really mean and nasty.
Yeah, that's where people are pissed off. They realize they have to go back to work and cut their hair, and so they're just going to stab some people. So, okay, well, there was another Digital Spine, and they do this. They'll just take a, and this might, you might find value in this, James. The people that buy stuff, we don't really care, but they'll take the Criterion release and they'll put it online and you can experience it in, with all the extras. So this week was Watership Down, which I love. And, and when John Hurt passed, I thought about this movie instantly because it's, you know, it has some dark themes and mortality, but love this movie. So it sounds like you've seen it.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that in the early 80s, parents would put on for their children thinking it was a kid's movie.
Yeah.
Giving them like decades of therapy.
Yes.
My girlfriend in high school could not see a rabbit in the flesh without having panic attacks because of Watership Down. Oh, but I work with a director who does hand-drawn animation. He's devoted his life to hand-drawn animation. So
You
like hand-drawn animation outside the world of Disney, Watership Down is one of the late 70s, early 80s was very much a kind of a little bit of a no man's land when it came to animated feature films, and that was one of the few exceptions. And so, yeah, Watership Down is great book, great movie, awesome stuff.
And I still haven't seen The Plague Dogs. And
I want to see that so badly. Yeah, I'm hoping
Martin told me to watch
that.
It. He says it's better than Watership Down.
Really?
Yeah, that's what he says. And it's been rumored for Criterion. Maybe it'll happen. I think for a while it was on Amazon Prime, but I think it's gone from there.
Oh, man.
But yeah, Watership Down is great. I mean, yeah, it's hand-drawn animation. It's a product of its time. And I don't know. You work in the industry, James. Do you think is that impressive animation for 1979?
Absolutely. It's very fluid. It's gorgeous. You know, is it as, for me, visually spectacular as like a Ralph Bakshi film like Wizards?
Sure.
But for me, that's more a matter of personal taste because one is like, you know, sci-fi and fantasy, like all blended together with like fusion jazz music and all these dark themes. So it all depends upon just your personal taste. But yeah, Watership Down's an essential animated feature.
I can see that animation being trying for like a kid. Like that would be something I would struggle to watch as a kid. Violence aside, but as an adult, I kind of appreciate that more. I don't want to say off the wall, I don't want to say outsider, but that kind of different art style, especially if you're only used to Disney. I appreciate that slightly. It looks a little bit more handmade. It looks a little bit more organic in a sense.
Well, when you can see some flaws in the illustrative style, yeah. As Bill Plimpton says, you can at least appreciate the hand of the artist. You know this is actually like
absolutely.
An organic living medium, and it's not something that's just been... I don't know. I love big budget animated films. Don't get me wrong, but sometimes they can be drained of any sort of rough edges that might possibly upset anybody, and that makes them feel a little bland.
Yeah, the rough edges add the character.
Yeah, that's imperfection like what... is part of. Yeah, it's part of it. In the supplements, because I watched it on the disc a couple years ago, they admit that they didn't know what they were doing. This was new territory for them, and I think for being neophytes and admitted neophytes, I think they did exceptionally well. I think they did. Probably surpassed any expectation.
Yeah, the movie's great.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's like when Wes Anderson did the stop-motion Fantastic Mr. Fox. He didn't have any experience with stop-motion, but sometimes as you're learning it, it makes you hurl yourself into it with such gusto and enthusiasm that you breathe an extra bit of life into it.
So. Yeah, and there's a lot of – that's not like perfect stop-motion either. Like compare that to like the stuff that Leica is doing or Leica. Leica does great work. Don't get me wrong. But stop motion is great because you almost can never fully remove those flaws. And I think
it's almost too perfect. Yeah.
That clunkiness is great.
And I love Fantastic Planet, but that's not, it looks magnificent, great sound, but that's not like, that's not perfect. That's not polished.
But it's so watchable.
Yeah,
very
required
much
required viewing. Yeah. It's a beautiful film.
So there's also a segment called Creative Marriages, Jean Cocteau and Jean Marais, and that was the Beauty and the Beast connection from earlier. Oh, I'm sorry, the Donkey Skin, because Donkey Skin was kind of paying homage to Beauty and the Beast, and
gotcha.
And Marais was in there in that. So he and Cocteau were openly homosexual lovers, which it's not a big deal now, but back then, even in France, that's you don't hear a lot of that. And especially, two iconic figures in film, two artists, and there's a little brief segment that talks about their collaboration and their partnership, which I enjoyed. I actually stopped before they got to Orpheus, just because that's the one Cocteau I haven't seen yet, and I just want to remain
good. You'll
remain
love it.
Pure. Yeah, but I loved all the stuff about Beauty and the Beast. I could watch anything about that Beauty and the Beast. Not so much the new one, probably, but I don't know. Have you guys seen the new one?
I just watched it. Jess and I saw it the other week. It's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. I thought it was decent. But I have a soft spot for the 90s animated one. So it's tough to compare.
Yeah, I do too. But you know what? The 90s animated one would not be a thing without the Cocteau. I mean, it lifted a lot of it. So
this is true.
What about you, James? You a fan of Cocteau or Marais?
I love Blood of a Poet and Beauty and the Beast and Orfeu, but I've never seen the Last Testament of Orpheus, I guess was his final film. But yeah, I studied Cocteau in college and got into his stuff. So I had to watch Orpheus a couple times, and it's a fascinating movie. I'm totally into it. As far as Beauty and the Beast is concerned, his film's extraordinary. I love the early 90s cartoon. I will not see the live action. I'm kind of going to plant my flag in resistance to live action remakes of beloved animation classics. I just I hate the whole trend.
You're just not doing that.
I'm not going to play. I'm taking my ball and I'm going home.
Sounds good. screw you guys. I'm going home.
Exactly.
Marais done a ton of work though. I was just looking at his filmography. He did Stealing Beauty. That's great. I think he's just an icon actor. I haven't watched as much Cocteau. I think I've seen probably 2/3 of his work. I haven't counted, but everything.
He didn't
make
that many movies. I mean, yeah, he didn't. He collaborated with Melville a little bit, like with like Les Enfants Terribles or whatever.
Yeah,
like
that one. I like that one.
Wasn't he like a Renaissance man of art in general? I also have not
seen
him. He's
a poet and an illustrator and a painter. He juggled a lot of balls. But there's like cafes in France where all the walls are just done in his style, and he was devoted himself to a lot of different creative endeavors. But also wrote probably the only favorable review of Orson Welles' Macbeth at the time of its release. So anyone who's a fan of Orson is always going to be my best bro for life.
Yeah, he has taste. Now the Orphic trilogy is out of print and has been for a while. There was a box set, and I think that's probably why I haven't watched it. And this is where my snob. It's not that I'm really I would watch it if I knew it was never coming back. I would watch it tomorrow, but I just want to wait for the best presentation. So,
well, Orpheus has the Blu-ray.
Okay, so there goes that excuse.
It's probably.
I guess I have to watch
right
that
now.
Tomorrow now. And so it's upstairs. I have it. Nice. Okay, all right. Well, there's always a Friday double feature, and this time there's A Room with a View and The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn. And I think the connection was Maggie Smith. I've not seen The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn and only heard about it yesterday. So. What's your thoughts? Are we down with this? I'll start with you, Dave.
I have not seen it, but it sounds fine.
It's Jack Clayton, so you know, he did The Innocents, so I think that deserves my attention.
Yeah.
Bob Hoskins, 1987.
I'm down. I'm totally down.
Yeah, I might have to watch this one. Where do I find the time, though? So, yeah. Room with a View, I think, is fun. I know Merchant Ivory's you know, not for everybody. Actually, I saw that Morris is coming out on 4K. Do you guys care about Merchant Ivory?
Well, quick question for you guys. I have, my entire life since childhood, very deliberately avoided ever seeing any Merchant Ivory film ever. Is there one that might convert me to the cause?
Don't ask me. I've never seen a single one. I haven't bought any of the Blu-rays.
I heard Remains of the Day a Merchant Ivory flick?
Yes. Okay, well,
I've heard Remains of the Day might be the one.
I'm actually going to go Room with a View here. I understand your position, James, because if you think about them, they're kind of, they seem like Masterpiece Theater, kind of stuffed shirt, old hat, period pieces, upper class. There's a lot under the surface that there's a lot of cultural commentary and class commentary, and it's actually a lot of humor. So you kind of just have to get through that. And I think A Room with a View shows – The Room with a View has male nudity.
Well, sign me up. My day isn't complete without a little ding-a-ling. So.
What's his name? Simon Callow. And what's the guy?
I love Simon Callow. He's written 3 brilliant books about Orson Welles. We did an episode about his book, One Man
That's
Band.
Right.
He's incredible. And Amadeus is the buddy of Wolfgang. And I'm a huge fan of Simon Callow.
Well, if you want to see his junk.
Sold. Yeah, so American.
And also,
I know what James is doing after this episode.
Who was the guy? I think it was Simon Callow. Who was the guy that was in Boxing Helena? And he's not a good actor.
That blonde dude?
Yeah, he's in that too.
He was like the late 80s stud that popped up for like a couple of movies. And he was such a, he just was like this, like looked like he'd been sculpted from marble, but was pretty vapid. And he was a weird phenomenon that didn't last very long.
It was he's not that great. He's okay in this. And then also a young and here you'll like this. It's a young Helena Bonham Carter, and she's pretty.
Wait, are we talking about Julian Sands? Because like in Julian my brain, Sands, yeah. I was like, I wonder if they're talking about Julian Sands. I've never even heard, seen this movie.
I don't know why Boxing Helena was the film. So, and I think was he in Boxing Helena?
I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Well, I just know that Julian Sands was at one of the horror conventions that is near us recently, and I was like, what's he doing these days other than horror conventions?
Yeah, he started doing some franchise that was just bad. Like some dude with wings. I forget what it was. I'm going to look it up later.
But, Warlock. It was the Warlock franchise back in the Warlock, day.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that was a career ender right there. I mean, he's worked. I think he's still working. But
he's got over 100 movie credits. But yeah, I mean, I saw him in Gothic. And
yeah, that's where I've seen him.
Yeah, what else was he in? Naked Lunch. Oh, okay. Boxing Helena, 1993, which there has some excellent skin sequences. But he made a lot of Warlock movies, which might have been a problem.
Yeah, he probably wanted that paycheck, and yeah. But I don't know that he really had the range. I don't know if I'm sure you like Daniel Day. Daniel Day plays the greatest snob, I think, in movie history.
Than George Sanders in All About Eve?
Yes. Wow. But over the top. I mean, you know how Day chooses scenery. Day Lewis chooses scenery. He does that here, but it's awesome. And this was really the breakthrough role that that made him recognized. So yeah, I'd watch Room with a View.
Okay, very cool. I will make it happen.
Make it happen. So we're done, guys. That was the episode. We just have piece of flair. So all right, James, I'm going to start with you. What's your piece of flair?
I got caught up on Leftovers in time for Sunday, when season 3 begins, and I was delightfully surprised by what a kick-ass, dark, dreary show it is. I absolutely loved it. But for flicks, I did the Polanski's Apartment trilogy, the first two of which are available by Criterion.
Yes.
But the last one, The Tenant, they need to complete the trilogy and make that sucker available.
The Tenant.
I still need to see that one.
The Tenant is excellent. And the other ones, Rosemary and Repulsion. We've actually brought them all up on the show, but now we've come full circle.
That.
The Tenant is—it's been rumored, and I don't remember where those rumors came from, but I think it's possible.
Yeah, it's got Isabella Gianni and Melva Douglas and Shelley Winters and Roman Polanski in the title role, and this is made right after his giant rape trial and everything. It's like at a very twisted part of his life, and it's a very twisted movie. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, and I'm not going to go into his personal scandals, but one thing I will say is I know that he does process a lot of his stuff in his films, like Macbeth. He processed the murder of his wife. I mean, it's 100%. There on the screen. I didn't actually think about The Tenant being him processing that situation. So whatever you think of the guy, I mean, I'm sure it's made a huge impact on his life.
Well, I always feel like love him or hate him, it's hard to deny the artistry in his films. Like Chinatown is fucking Chinatown. Like Repulsion is Repulsion. Like these are extraordinary films. So yeah, I mean, Caravaggio murdered a guy, but does that mean his paintings aren't good paintings? Like
And I made the mistake of bringing up Woody Allen on your show, and that was more based on just reputation.
Oh, and Becky jumped all over you. I remember.
She did. We had a good chat, and she's right. I just threw that name out just because those are the two guys.
Well, Becky's a smart cookie, and she knows, she does her homework, and she loves Woody Allen. And if someone wants to make aspersions, she will happily have that conversation. But she comes armed to the teeth with a lot of facts. So yeah, she's ready to throw it out.
And actually, that's a debate I've avoided. And she pointed out some things that were very interesting. So I have a stance now. I'm not going to talk about it, but you can probably piece things together.
Well, I said a lot of dumb things in my podcast about him, even though I love his movies, but I spread misinformation on several occasions, and she finally called me to task on it, and we just devoted an episode where she got to speak her piece on Woody Allen. So yeah, Becky, she's always welcome on Wrong Reel.
I don't want to come out with an opinion because I will get hate mail either direction, but
that's the thing. It's probably too late. It's a no-win conversation.
It is.
Finally, what I've realized in social media, when it comes to controversial filmmakers, you're going to get hate either from people who love their films if you shit on them, or if you're going to get hate from people who hate the person if you celebrate the movies. So you just got to follow your own inner compass. And as a cinephile, if you're drawn to their movies, I feel like you just got to wrap your arms around the fact that you're drawn to their movies, and the rest will work itself out later.
And we talked about Fassbender.
I tweeted about Woody Allen and got a lot of perspectives. And you know what? It was great to hear everyone's perspective about it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, frankly, you can't take things seriously. I'm sure there are assholes out there and they're terrible people and they're great artists. But, you know, you talk about separating the art from the artist, but I think it's more just don't get worked up, you know.
Also, I love history, and you can't have a complete view of the history of film as a medium from 1895 up to today without encountering some pretty slimy characters, and I feel like you're doing yourself a disservice if you're like, I'm not going to learn anything about that period of film history because I don't like the unsavory characters involved. And yeah, I just find – I like the entire sprawling narrative of the last 130 years of movies and just find it just endlessly rewarding to study all the dark parts as well as the bright parts.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a number I can put on this, but if you look at just Hollywood through history, I'm going to say 50% terrible people, probably.
Yeah, that's probably
and
probably
we probably don't
generous.
Know.
I think that's a conservative guess.
Yeah. So, okay, Dave, what's your piece of flair?
So my piece of flair is a movie that I'm sure all your listeners are very excited about. It's a movie that was just released. The next chapter in the Fast and Furious saga, Fate of the Furious. I loved it. I have an unabashed love of these movies. I would call them guilty pleasures, but I have no guilt about it.
Really?
I don't know what it is. Like, I was sitting there in the theater thinking, why am I having so much fun? Because I think that they're just fun movies. It's like the movie you want to have a beer with. It's not like Michael Bay, where I feel as though he thinks he's better than his audience and he's condescending down to them. This movie's just like, hey, let's hang out. Let's have a good time. There's going to be some cars. It's going to be fun. And I actually thought this had some really well-directed action sequences. Had a great fight scene where you could actually tell what's going on, which I think is rare, especially in mainstream Hollywood these days. So, I don't know. It's
right.
I think that the whole argument of shut your brain off and enjoy a movie is a dumb argument. But for this, like, hey, just watch cars drive. They're fun. And it's they abandoned logic like five movies ago. Each movie progressively jumps the shark, and for some reason, I enjoy it more and more each time.
Just the quote I'm pulling from that little short take or whatever is just watch cars drive.
Yeah, just watch cars drive.
That's fine. That's what it is.
What more do you need? Just watch cars drive.
Yeah, we were in some online discussion, and one person was talking about how basically you have to watch just a certain type of film, and to the expense of, you know, to people that don't watch this type of film and they just watch stuff like Fast and the Furious, they're just, you know, subhumans. It was foreign. People that won't watch subtitles are subhumans. And maybe they're not as cultured as the three of us. But.
Well, you know what? There was a lot of subtitles in Fate of the Furious.
There was, okay.
Because the beginning of the movie is set in Cuba.
Oh, they made people read the screen.
And you know what? No one in the theater complained. They were all having too good of a time.
I don't care. I know rocket scientists that don't watch, that have never seen a Bergman. That doesn't mean they're not smart. That just means they have different tastes. And I also fully am in favor of leaving your brain at the door. You got to have fun sometimes. We've talked about like Giallo and stuff. You know, that's, you can analyze it, but you can't. I'm just a moment ago, I was talking about Stagecoach, and I just left my brain at the door and had a good time. So are you a fan of that franchise, James?
I am not. I've seen the first seven. I had to get prepared. I had to see them all for an episode 2 years ago about Fast and the Furious, or Furious 7, whenever the seventh one was called. So yesterday we actually recorded our episode about Fate of the Furious. So what I did, I supervised the recording and I asked questions, but I did not see the movie. And I just let Brittany and Mikhail, who love the franchise, speak their piece. I didn't want to be a buzzkill and talk about why it's just not for me. I don't actively dislike it. I just it's like kind of like football. If it just disappeared, my life would just proceed the same way that it's proceeded all along. It has no ripple effect that affects me one way or another. And so I just finally realized, you know, I love like Marvel. I love Star Trek. I love a lot of like franchises out there. I love Bond. That's just not my franchise. Mm-hmm. But for people who is their franchise, more power to them, because I've got my flavor that is equally difficult to defend.
I know you do. I've heard some of those flavors. So, well, I didn't like the first four, but then I saw the critic reviews for Fast 5, and I did watch it. And I remember when my wife made fun of me, she said, "Why are you watching a Fast and the Furious movie?" I was like, "Well, you know, I'll give it a shot. I'll give anything a shot." And I enjoyed it. But
that's
then
the best one.
Yeah, then I watched 6, and I was like, all right, yeah, it's getting too silly, and I haven't watched 7, and I won't watch this one. And
I want to do a supercut of just like a scene from the first movie compared to a scene from the 8th movie, because the first movie they're stealing TV DVD combos, and in this one they're stealing nuclear launch codes.
Okay,
that's what blows my mind about the franchise, though. I can't think of any franchise that's better pivoted into greater success at the halfway point, where they completely changed the brand. They were basically street level criminals with pretty mundane concerns in the first one, and now they're basically the A Team or the Avengers or G.I. Joe, whatever you want to call them. But they're basically like superhero criminals, and it's obviously paid off at the box office. But I love the fact that they reassessed and just changed completely the direction of the franchise, and now it's like The Rock and Jason Statham. It's basically The Expendables. So yeah. I'm blown away by how nimble they were with the direction of the franchise.
It shouldn't have worked.
I saw a graph that showed like it was a graph of the number of car driving in the movies, and this last movie I haven't seen, and I probably won't see it, but it like had the least amount of car driving of all the movies.
That makes sense. That makes sense. There's a lot of non-car scenes.
So the rumor is they're going to space.
Oh, yeah.
I heard they shot that rumor. If they go to space, I might be back in. If they drive a car through a spaceship, that might be enough.
No,
if Air Bud and his puppies can go to space, then the Fast and the Furious crew can go to space.
There you go. Yeah. If you want
Jason
to revamp
space,
every franchise
needs to go to space eventually.
Yeah, you can Moonraker that baby.
Absolutely.
So.
They
Bond
have to.
Space, yeah.
Yeah.
The only way to go is up.
So my piece of flair, I'm actually going to, since we're talking franchises, I'm going to sneak in the big one. This isn't what I intended, but since the Star Wars trailer came out, I'll mention that. I'm not the biggest Star Wars fan, but I appreciate it. And of course, I like Kurosawa, so there's ties there. But I thought the trailer seemed okay. It doesn't really reveal much, but it's a teaser. It doesn't really have to. So I was into Force Awakens a little bit. Rogue One a little bit, too. So I know, James, you're probably going to talk about that Star Wars trilogy till your nuts turn blue. So,
Well, I'm a Star Wars fan, but there are definitely people who are way more into it. I mean, I grew up on the original trilogy because I'm a child of the 80s,
right,
and I've played some of the video games. But, you know, I work with a guy at Plimpton Studios who has, like, read every single novel with the word Star Wars in the title ever, and, like, read every comic, and, like, gets interviewed in documentaries like The People versus George Lucas. Like, there are levels of Star Wars fanaticism that I don't even come close to approaching. I really love the original trilogy, but that doesn't make me unique in any way. So I'd say if I'm probably like a yellow belt or like a green belt, like when it compares like to like the true Star Wars black belts who have made it their religion for the last 30, 40 years.
Okay, well, I think we're on the same page then. Maybe I'm like lime green. I don't know. But yeah, I think it's okay. And I'll watch the next one, and I'm a little encouraged. I like what they're doing with some of the characters, but it's still, you know, it's escapist. It's fun. You just leave your brain at the door, and that's fine. But my real piece of flair is, speaking of going to space, is, and I mentioned it last week, but it came out. So MST3K, I'm a super nerd for that. And I just love bad movies, and I love people making fun of it. And I love smart references that, you know, I do feel clever getting. And so I've watched the first two so far, and they've had a reference to Solaris. They had reference to Carnival of Souls. And they've had other great references, and I'm just like, and they're funny too. They had a reference to Michael McDonald, the Doobie Brother, just inane, random, but so funny. And the second episode of the new season is absolutely bonkers, and it's just so much fun. And it has the song at the end, which is actually in the movie, one of the most depressing songs I've ever heard. I don't know if they read the lyrics when they put it in the movie, but anyway, MST3K is out on Netflix, and I recommend at least watch the first two, or just the second one. You know, the first one was okay. So, all right, guys. Well, that's it. So where can we find you online, Dave?
You can find me on Twitter at Cinema versus Dave. That is Cinema VS Dave.
All right, James. Jamie,
you can find
James.
Me on Twitter at Colrex, and you can find the podcast Wrong Reel on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and all those usual platforms.
And Twitter, too. Wrong Reel has a Twitter.
We do indeed.
A very
at
active
Wrong
Twitter.
Reel.
You can find me on Twitter, AWES505. You can find the show on Twitter, Criterion_now. And it's on the Criterion Cast feed. So, subscribe to that, please. Listen to all our fun obscure French cinema movies, and if you're into the into the podcast, watch the Duvivier movies. I yearn for a treat, and I think you'll enjoy our discussions. So, all right, guys, I hope you enjoyed it. That wasn't too bad, was it, James?
Yeah, I had a panic attack last night because I felt very ill-prepared, but I had a fine time.